Pondering which fancy restaurant we will take her out to first, she cracks the door open and holds out her hand for a smaller size of a fitted, knee-length dress in royal blue. Handing it to her, I glimpse, through the gaping sleeve openings of the too big dress, a coin-size blob on her ribcage in a bluish-green shade of black that seems somehow wrong for a bruise. The door closes before I can ask her about it, and the dress doesn't suit her, so we don't end up buying it. We have plenty of other options. We walk out with four giant shopping bags stuffed to their tops, two bags apiece, like a scene in a movie about rich and powerful women. And I do feel powerful, almost as if we've gotten away with something, though the four-figure total on the receipt shows otherwise. Julie is smiling, too, unabashedly, wearing a knit top and jeans that we ripped the tags off right at the register while the long receipt was still whirring its way out of the printer. The sun came out from behind clouds while we were inside and is now steaming away the new puddles in the parking lot, high and bright. Everything sparkles. I think with a sharp thrill of Tom at his computer, seeing the transaction come up in his linked accounting software. It's more than our monthly house payment. Only late at night, just as I'm drifting off, does that precise shade of bluish-greenish-black on her ribcage evoke the word tattoo. The next day, I drive her to a pebbled concrete office complex off Memorial Drive. Tom's phone call having yielded a referral to the dark and slightly down-at-heel office of Carol Morse, Psy D. Julie goes in, and in the waiting area, where the ficus trees are mysteriously flourishing in the absence of natural light, I pull out a book on Byron and landscape, then put it down and spend 90 minutes paging through magazines instead. I think about the many appointments in my future, all the waiting rooms in store for me, and hope they update the magazines regularly. On the way home, Julie asks if she can drive herself to her therapy appointments. Tom and I argue about it for 3 days straight.
"She can't drive without a license," he says. "End of story."
"The therapist's office isn't that far away. She won't have to go on the highway."
"Then we'll get her a bike."
But in a city without sidewalks, a bike feels more dangerous to me than a car.
"And have her get honked at? Even hit? People get abducted off bikes, Tom, and the bus is just as bad."
"Unprotected," I want to say. I think of Julie walking along the feeder road.
"Of course she'll get a license, but it takes months, and there are all those tests and forms and documents. What does she do until then? She'll have to get a vision test."
"She should. There are reasons for those things,"
Tom says. But I can tell he's wavering, and so I keep fighting. It's the first thing Julie has really asked me for, and she asked me, not Tom. I assume she wants to be alone in the car for the same reason I do. That sheltered, armored feeling of sitting high up behind the tinted windows in the recycled air-conditioned air, the total privacy. It's something I can give her that's better than clothes. In the end, we compromise. I sign her up for the midsummer session of driver's ed at the community college near our house, and Tom agrees to take Julie out for driving lessons now so she can get herself to therapy and back, carefully, using the neighborhood roads. The private lessons are what clinches it. His resolve crumbles in the face of her obvious delight at the prospect, and for the next week they wake up conspiratorially early and head off to various parking structures around town for a few hours. When they come back, we eat lunch together, and then Tom goes to work while Julie and I swim in the pool. In the afternoons, I take her out shopping. We buy all her bedroom furniture in one trip to IKEA, as if she's a college student, or to her therapy appointment when she has one, or a few times to an afternoon movie. After a family dinner, we watch TV with Jane curled up nearby, absorbed in her notebook. It's a cozy routine. One where Julie is always accounted for, and our time together is comfortably filled with tasks, so no one has to reach far for things to talk about that aren't Julie's 8-year absence, or find reasons to gently touch her forearm that aren't, at least not obviously, about checking to make sure she's still there. For the first few weeks, this routine feels like it could last forever, in spite of minor disturbances. Tom answers the phone sharply when he doesn't recognize the caller ID, telling the reporters that we are not interested in talking.
I don't know when, he snaps. Our family needs privacy right now.
Eventually he turns the ringer off, and I sink back into the bliss of knowing he is taking care of things, as he did in the days after it happened. In the back of my mind are certain topics I avoid thinking about. My job, Jane's incompletes, the sane, the safe. But then I send my department chair an email telling him my grades will be late and decide that Jane, who has grown quieter in Julie's presence, must be making progress on her late papers. What else could she be writing about in her notebook all the time? And when Julie starts driving after a few weeks of early morning lessons with Tom, she gets to her appointments and back just fine, as I knew she would. This is our new normal, and it feels like something we are all learning together as a family. Tom and I even start having sex again, something that hasn't happened regularly for years. He touches me gingerly as if he can sense that my skin feels almost raw. Julie has been in the house for a few weeks, and though I'm getting used to it, it still feels like someone has rubbed me all over with a rasp. Every pore seems to be open, every hair a fine filament ready to shoot me full of sensation at the slightest breeze. I have been fighting for so long to stifle sensation. I remember when the grief was so potent I would lie on the sofa with the television on, drinking vodka gimlets, one after the other, just waiting to pass out, staying as still as possible, teaching myself the art of numbness. And now it is as if I've been dropped into scalding water and the numbness has peeled away, and the skin underneath is affronted by air. If there is something missing, if I am afraid to love her quite as much as before, it is only because the potential for love feels so big and so intense that I fear I will disappear in the expression of it, that it will blow my skin away like clouds and I will be nothing. I wake up one morning with Jane standing over me, shaking my elbow. For a moment, caught in dreams I can't remember, I think we're doing the whole thing over again. Mom, she whispers urgently. Mom, can you wake up? I reach a hand instinctively over to Tom. Don't wake Dad, just come quick, okay? I'm naked under the covers, I realize in time to keep from pushing them off me. Jane sees. I'll wait outside. It's Julie, she adds unnecessarily, since even as I wake up completely, I'm still reliving that day. I skip the bathrobe and pull on jeans and yesterday's shirt in case we need to get right into the car. Gone? I ask when I'm out of the bedroom, my skin clamping shut under the air conditioning. Jane looks at me oddly and shakes her head. No, nothing like that. I think she's sick. We're still whispering as she leads me upstairs. Jane peers down the hall at the closed bathroom door. It's locked, she says helplessy. How long? I don't know, she says. Since before I got up, half an hour ago. I thought she was taking a bath, but then I heard her moaning or something. I knocked, but she won't answer. Her voice is quavering. I walk to the bathroom door, knock softly. Julie? There is no moaning now, only a rhythmic click and shuffle that I associate immediately with a night spent doubled over on the toilet. Baby, are you okay in there? Are you hurting? Two words, sent explosively outward on an expulsion of breath, barely audible. What?
Go away,
followed by a gasp of pain. I turn to Jane.
Get a blanket from the hall closet and put it in the car. My keys are on the table. I'll be down in a few minutes.
She leaves immediately to follow my orders. Facing the bathroom door, I say,
Julie, you're going to have to let me in. You're going to unlock the door, okay?
Nothing but a moan and the rhythm of the clicking toilet seat. The next thing I know, I am in the bathroom. I don't remember this part, but Tom tells me later that he woke up to pounding, mine, and screaming, Julie's, and that by the time he made it to the hall in his boxers, my arm had already disappeared up to the shoulder in a ragged hole in the bathroom door, and then I was turning the doorknob from the inside, pulling my arm out and opening the door. Between my bloody fist and the blood on the bathroom floor, there was blood everywhere, and he turned around and around looking for the intruder who had laid waste to the household. But however I got in, when I see Julie, I know what's happening to her right away. I had one myself, after Jane. It's a painful, bloody thing, though I remember wishing during the worst times that I had lost Julie that way instead of the other. Tears are streaming down her face, and I wrap a towel around her shoulders and help her to her feet. "I'll call you from the hospital," I tell Tom, who is still shaking as he follows us down the stairs and into the kitchen. The last thing I say to him, as he stands by the island in his boxers, is, "I didn't know we even had a gun." More to remind him he's holding it than anything else. He stares down at it in his hand as if he hadn't known either. "She's okay," I tell Tom over the phone from my chair in the waiting area. "Ovarian cysts can be very painful when they rupture. Tell Jane it's okay." He protests. "Yes, they're concerned about the blood, too, but they don't think it's anything serious. It was mostly mine from the door. The ultrasound showed a tiny, irregular smudge, already half disintegrating. Washed out in the early morning, tiny bits of tissue in a thick, red exudus. When she saw what was on the monitor, she went pale and silent, dropped my hand, and said, "Get out." I got out, but before I did, I saw her face. She knew. I end the call with Tom, put the phone back in my purse, and sit. If any of the staff in the emergency department heard me and knew I was lying, they didn't care enough to give me even a glance. I bet they've heard plenty of miscarriages become ovarian cysts on the phone with Dad. I reach for a magazine and wince at the pain in my bandaged knuckles. Thinking of the clothes I bought her, I grimace. Have the snug jeans become more snug in the past few weeks? Have I failed to notice? I remember the tattoo. Remember above all what she told the police. 6 months. Now 7. And hate myself for thinking, she lied. She lied. She lied. But omissions aren't necessarily lies, are they? This is what the therapy is for, telling the horrible details that don't add up but make all the difference. Surely that's what she does in the therapist's office for 90 minutes twice a week, talks to a surrogate me. Isn't that the theory? A trained professional onto whom she can project a version of me that, unlike the real me, will be able to handle everything, hold everything, make it all make sense? The therapist, Carol Morse, suddenly seems like the answer. She can't tell me anything confidential, of course, but maybe under the circumstances, a pregnancy, a miscarriage, Julie's health at stake, she'll find a way to give me some insights into what's going on with my daughter. There's so much more to her than I know, but I can handle Julie's truth. I've already had the worst thing happen to me that can ever happen to a parent, and now, in a sense, Julie has too. It's something we share. When she's finally discharged, we walk to the car. Another late night has turned into early morning during our time in the hospital. The sun is coming up, the freeway still clear, the heat just a soft shimmer that promises more to come. We drive for a few minutes in silence. "It was the guard," she says, "in the helicopter. I don't know why I didn't want to say, I guess because," she struggles, "it wasn't really rape." Pause. I take in this detail, try to make it fit. "What I mean is, I offered. I thought he'd be less likely to kill me. I didn't want to tell you, because I was ashamed. Anyway, I thought," she gasps a little, "I thought I couldn't get pregnant. My period has never been regular since—" she stops when a tear rolls down my cheek. "Well, ever." I nod. This woman is older than 21. I am not as old as she is, and I am 46, with lines of mourning etched all over my face that will never go away. But she knew. I saw her face when she looked at the ultrasound screen. "I love you," I say, and it's the truth, the absolute truth. But in this new world, after the miscarriage, it sounds like a lie. "Mom," she says despairingly.
I won't tell your father or Jane. This is between us.
A warm wave of relief radiates from her as she settles back in her seat. This is what she has wanted all along. She looks out the window and I look at the road ahead, and we are closer in our secret than we have ever been. Julie woke up to a fresh round of cramps with a strangled cry. The television was on, but muted. Was it the same movie she fell asleep to or a different one? While she was still half asleep, Tom came running down the stairs from her bedroom, which he was using as an office during the daytime, while they figured out where to move his desk. This made her nervous, but she didn't want to say anything about it. Looking at him now, standing at the bottom of the stairs, she briefly remembered him from last night, holding a gun. She wondered where it was now.
Did I hear you calling? Are you okay?
I'm fine, just a bad dream. At first, she'd dreamed of Cal, but it got bad near the end when the cramps started rocketing through her body louder and louder. She couldn't remember the worst of it with Tom standing there, just a feeling of dirt all around her mouth and the colors yellow and red. The shades of the Afghan she noticed with disgust, throwing it off her. Now that she was awake, the sharp pain in her abdomen was already subsiding to a dull, empty ache.
Can I make you some tea?
I'd like to get out of the house.
The air in here was somehow both cold and stifling, and the big windows made her feel like some kind of specimen under glass. Or maybe it was the way they all watched her.
Can I take the car?
Your mother left a few minutes ago. Jane's got mine,
he said swiftly. She could tell the idea of her driving without a license still made him uncomfortable.
Your mom should be back soon. She was just going by her office for some late-term papers. Why don't you keep resting for a while? You could watch another movie.
She swiveled her feet to the ground.
It's okay. I'll just take a walk.
He watched her doubtfully as she pushed herself to standing. Her legs felt quivery, as if her feet were still in the stirrups.
I'll be fine, Dad, she forced herself to say. I just need some headspace. Let me go get dressed, okay?
He nodded.
I'll be in the kitchen.
She went up to her room, opened the closet door, and stared at the rows of brand new flats and boots, some she hadn't worn yet, that were still in their boxes. She could see, down the hall in Jane's room, a pair of beat-up Converse high-top sneakers slouching toe to heel by the side of Jane's bed, where it was her habit to kick them off. On an impulse, she walked down the hall and grabbed them. They gaped a little, so she added a second pair of socks, and instead of wrapping the laces around her ankles like Jane, she laced them all the way to the top and double-tied the knot. She wanted something that wouldn't come off if she had to start running. The thought made her legs feel wobblier than ever. She grabbed a hoodie out of Jane's closet, then thought better of it, Tom might notice, and hung it back up. There was nothing like a hoodie in her own closet, just cardigans and blazers and other things she'd never worn before. They'd excited her in the store for that reason, but now their unfaded pastels looked like candy to her, too visible. She grabbed the most subdued cardigan, a soft gray one, and put it on. Then she reached under her brand new and punishingly stiff mattress, slid the phone out from between it and the box spring, and tucked it into her front pocket, hoping the cardigan would mostly cover it. Downstairs, she breezed past Tom, grabbed her new purse, and yelled, "I'll be back before dinner," over her shoulder as the door swung shut behind her. The outside air hit her face like steam off a bowl of soup. Sitting in Tom and Anna's freezing house, you forgot the sweltering heat waiting on the other side of the window. She peeled her cardigan off at the bottom of the driveway and stuffed it into her purse. At the end of the block, she slipped the phone out of her pocket and turned it on, grateful for her last-minute inspiration to ditch it with her IDs in the front bushes before ringing the doorbell. Losing consciousness had not been part of the plan. Maybe it was the heat and all the walking, but when Jane stepped into the hallway, Julie had thought she was seeing Charlotte's ghost. The hospital had not been part of the plan either, but at least the doctor had shed light on certain particulars. Particulars that, of course, Anna now knew too. No wonder she'd felt so weak. This whole time she'd thought it was love she was fighting against, or tearing herself away from,
that feeling of warm belonging that threatened to betray her whenever Cal looked at her. Now she knew the betrayal ran deeper, down into her blood, bones, and tissue. No wonder she'd felt violated. No wonder she'd felt possessed. It was a lucky thing he never found out what was inside her. Recovering the phone had been tricky since they watched her so closely those first few days. But on the third day, she'd slipped out for the mail and picked it up on the way back in. Thank God the phone had stayed dry under the awning, and the IDs were all still there, rubber-banded to its back. When she'd powered it up, the screen flashed on, and there was Cal, smiling at her with that infuriating expression of faith and love she'd drunk in so deeply and grown so strong on. Strong enough to remember who she really was and why he couldn't find out. By the time she saw the article in the library that day, Cal had dropped her off there to study the GED books, she was strong enough to tear herself away. She had scrubbed everything else off her phone before she was out of Seattle, but she couldn't quite bring herself to get rid of Cal. She felt as if he were with her still in some indefinable way. When, at the hospital, she'd learned what it was, she'd thought maybe, somehow, when she was finished here, she could go back. She knew it was a stupid idea, and her body agreed. It had made the decision for her. She took one last long look at the face on the screen, and for a moment she was lying next to him again, her fingers tracing his chest lightly. His fingers twined in her hair, listening as he described his mother's white face, one eye swollen shut, framed in the rear window of his aunt's Volkswagen, sending one last blank look in the direction of the small black boy crying at the kitchen window before twisting her blonde head away and turning her back on him forever. She got the point, and it wasn't just that she, too, was a blonde. Sometimes people had to leave, she'd thought to herself. She took a deep breath and pressed delete. Then she noticed the new voicemail message. Not recognizing the number, she pushed play and listened, but a moment later jerked the phone away from her ear like it had bitten her. How many times would she have to delete him before he was gone? And how many times would it still hurt? She'd never picked up, and she'd stopped listening to the messages after the first few. They all said the same thing. Now he was trying her from different numbers, hoping to catch her off guard. She glanced once more at the unknown number, and then with a jolt recognized the area code, Portland, Oregon. It might be a coincidence, a cell phone borrowed from a friend, but what if he actually had gone to Portland? It might mean he was trying to find her, following her trail, starting with Will. Of course that's where he would start. He'd always wanted an excuse to confront Will and get her stuff back. He'd said facing the past was important, as if he'd know the first thing about it. He could be finding out, though, right now, and once he started in that direction, how long would it be until he found her? Looking around at Tom and Anna's neighborhood, she could barely believe she was here, much less picture Cal turning up. Empty of pedestrians in the heat of the afternoon, the neighborhood had high white curbs but no sidewalks, and she walked in the street, stepping around straggling ropes of soft tar. She passed house after house, all of them huge to her after Cal's pinched Seattle apartment, their plush lawns trimmed with fat shrubs and clumps of begonias, so perfect and motionless in the dead air they looked like silk flowers. Some of the porches had columns, like plantation houses. Following the noise of traffic, she stepped out of the subdivision and started walking along a busy thoroughfare. Cars spat hot breath and gravel at her ankles as they raced by. There was no sidewalk here, either, no curb even, just a narrow trail worn in the crabgrass near the greasy roadside before it plunged into runoff ditches padded at the bottom with tangled weeds. She walked past a rambling strip mall. Kroger, Quick Clean, Jenny's Gifts, the streaky glass box of a Dairy Queen. The only logical destination of this ragged path was the bus stop. She cast a glance toward the kiosk and saw three women waiting for the bus in service uniforms, each with a rolling cart full of bottles. Cleaning ladies. Her back hurt just looking at them. As she passed a McDonald's, she saw a long blue awning peeking out from the strip center behind it. Bobby's Pool Hall, in dingy white block letters. She walked toward it in relief. So there were hiding places here after all. Although the other stores in the strip center had glass fronts, she noted that Bobby's windows were covered with weather-beaten plywood and wondered if there was any business in the back. Not that she needed any, she hurriedly told herself. She was going to be here only a few weeks. But it wasn't a bad idea to find out what was around. Besides, she had money in her wallet, and maybe what she really wanted was to sit for a few hours away from the roadside, drinking away the pain in her gut. At this time of the afternoon, there were only a few barflies. They sat close to the entrance, talking with a curly-haired woman behind the bar, who laughed loudly as she wedged limes on a cutting board. None of them paid any attention to her until she leaned against the bar. Then the bartender stopped laughing abruptly.
"What do you want, honey?"
she squinted.
"Job, you gotta be 18."
"Corona, please," the woman laughed.
"You're gonna have to show me some ID, hon."
Julie dug through her new wallet and pulled out one that said she was 24. Even as she handed it over, she felt a moment of panic. It was a California driver's license, a real one, the kind you can get in a lot of trouble for stealing. The bartender gave it a long, hard look, then glanced at her, then back down at the ID.
"Mercedes Rodriguez," she said, drawing out the syllables like it was an impossible name for anyone to have.
"Mercy," she said automatically. The last time she'd used Mercy, she'd had short brown hair, but it was dark in Bobby's pool hall, and the wide cheekboned face and blue eyes looked close enough. "Mercy, Mercy," she told her face, "look like Mercy." It almost worked. She could feel the woman struggling to care. Then someone called, "Bev!" from the end of the bar, and the bartender glanced anxiously over her shoulder, and by the time she looked back at Mercy, she was having none of it.
"Sorry, señorita," she said, all the patience draining from her voice. "You don't look 24, and it's an out-of-state ID. I gotta be careful in this neighborhood. For all I know, you wandered over from the high school."
Bev threw the ID down on the counter and hustled off.
This goddamn city.
She wasn't planning to be here long, but she'd already flashed a fake ID within 10 blocks of Tom and Anna's house and been turned down. "Don't shit where you eat" meant something different when she was working at the Black Rose, but it applied here, too. She grabbed the ID off the counter and shoved it back into her pocket. Now the two men at the bar were staring at her. One of them said,
"Come on, Bev, have a heart."
The other chimed in.
"She's old enough. I can always tell that ring's on a tree," he guffawed.
Now she really had to get away. On a sudden instinct, she pulled the phone out and dialed one of the numbers Tom and Anna had made her write down on a scrap of paper and keep in her new wallet.
"Hello?"
The voice had the doubtful tone of someone picking up an unknown number.
"Hey, Jane," she said. "It's Julie." "Where are you? What number is this?"
She looked out the window and saw a sign across the street.
"I'm at the Starbucks by our house. I borrowed a phone off someone. Listen, I had to get out of there. Mom and Dad were hovering. Can you pick me up?"
"Are you at the Starbucks on Memorial?"
"Yeah, I have to go. This lady needs her phone back."
"Just hang on. I'm at my friend's house. I'll be there in a few minutes." Jane hung up. She slammed the bar door behind her as hard as she dared, but it bounced on a cushion of air 6 inches from the frame, and she could still hear the voices inside laughing at her as she hurriedly crossed the street. 15 minutes later, Jane pulled into the Starbucks parking lot in Tom's SUV, rolled down the window, and said,
"Nice shoes."
"Thanks." Julie looked down and saw Jane's Converse on her feet.
"I mean, I'm sorry."
"It's okay." Despite the dark hair and bangs, Jane didn't look much like Charlotte at all. Jane was taller, stronger, Julie told herself.
"Mom got me all these flats," she apologized. "I just wanted something I could walk in."
She pulled the heavy passenger side door open and climbed in.
"I said it was okay."
Looking closely at Jane's face, especially when she smiled, Julie could tell she had never been very far from home. College didn't count, even if it was halfway across the country. It was still closer to home than a single bus ride could take you. If you looked past Jane's piercings, two, nose and eyebrow,
Tattoos, two small ones, one on her shoulder and one on her hip, and Anna didn't know about either. And hair, the bleach in green was clearly a home job, but the black dye was from a salon. You saw a girl who'd never had to take the bus all that much. Julie regretted putting her own hair through this last round of bleach. It had looked smooth enough at first, but now the ends were getting ragged, the part below her shoulders breaking off and poofing out. Worst of all, darker hair was creeping in at her hairline. If she hadn't needed to look the part so desperately, she could probably have gotten away with dirty blonde. But she hadn't wanted to be a dirty blonde. She'd wanted to be Julie. Jane clicked her keys against the wheel impatiently.
So, where are we going?
I want to chop all this off, Julie said, holding out a handful of split ends.
Like, right now?
Yeah, right now. And dye it, maybe. I figured you'd know a good place for that. Jane looked impressed.
I can take you to the place I go. It's in Montrose. What color are you going to dye it?
She squinted shrewdly.
Better not be black.
I don't know, maybe red? She said without thinking. At the Rose, she'd always made bank with red hair. Besides, white blonde Julie was starting to get to her. She'd stared at the pictures of the missing girl and at herself in the mirror beforehand, but when she started playing Julie for Anna and Tom and Jane, something shifted. She saw Julie's innocence in the way all three of them looked at her, and it was unnerving. Anna, in particular, watched her as if she might break. Jane was already pulling out of the parking lot, her strong jaw set under its sprinkling of covered-up acne, saying, "Cool, let's get out of here." If Julie was worried about Anna, she should have started with Jane in the first place. Shutting Anna out was Jane's superpower. Tom's Range Rover was a smooth ride, just more ease and luxury so built into Jane's existence she didn't even know it was there. Jane wove in and out of the four-lane traffic on Westheimer as she drove toward the city, the SUV soon dwarfed by hawking black Suburbans with tinted windows, shiny trucks that were all tire and no flatbed, a Hummer that looked like it could transform into a robot. A few lanes away, a silver convertible idled like a half-melted bullet in the sun. The apartments gave way to sparkling white office buildings, set on lots kissed around their edges with manicured shrubs and palm trees. Everything gleamed, even the street signs, which were mounted on giant chrome arcs.
Can you believe how much the Galleria has changed?
She caught the small dip in Jane's voice and immediately felt a prickling on the back of her neck, alerting her to a shared memory she was in no position to ignore.
Yeah, I know, she said. Do you remember that time Mom dropped us off at the Galleria to do our Christmas shopping? That's what I was thinking about, too.
I thought we were so cool, Jane went on, her eyes on the taillights ahead of them. The traffic light had changed, and they were inching sluggishly forward, but they weren't going to make it past the danger zone on this green. It felt like we were so grown up. You must have been in, what, sixth or seventh grade? Because... She broke off. And I would have been in fourth or fifth. We bought lunch at that one fancy food court place with the crepes. Do you remember splitting up for an hour to buy each other's presents? That was my favorite part. We, like, synchronized our watches and met at the bakery afterward. She laughed. I even doubled back and hid which direction I was coming from so you wouldn't guess where I bought your present. I think it was Claire's or something. Jane's voice tugged at her ear. But Julie was distracted by a boy of around 12 or 13 in a T-shirt and saggy, wide-legged blue jeans weighed down with a heavy wallet chain, who was striding through the still sidewalkless guts of the drainage ditch parallel to the road. His tangled hair was long and brown and very deliberately shielding his face as he marched, hands in pockets, visibly sweating. He reached the base of one of the chrome arcs, which proved to be a formidable obstacle at ground level. Trapped between an evergreen shrub and the curved chrome, he hiked up his billowing, half-shredded pants leg with one hand and stepped over it, like a cartoon lady pulling up her skirts to step over a puddle.
Julie?
Jane's voice came back to her, and she realized she'd missed a question. The music was quieter. Jane must have turned it down.
Do you remember what you did that time when we split up? tried on prom dresses, she said. Pretended I was a princess.
Oh, Jane said and laughed.
Well, that definitely explains why I ended up getting a gift certificate from Walden Books that year.
She knew better than to let this moment pass because of some stupid kid.
I thought you loved reading.
You could have picked out a book, though.
Impossibly, Jane sounded hurt, although she was still laughing. You know, I don't think I ever used the gift certificate. I mean, after everything happened. The light changed, and they barely made it through the intersection this time, moving at a snail's pace. She watched the boy swim through the weeds by the side of the road until they gained on him, pulled ahead, and finally passed him. In the rearview mirror, he looked almost motionless. She turned back to Jane.
Look, pull the car over. Do you want me to get you the newest Babysitter's Club book? They're probably on number 10,000 by now.
It worked. Jane laughed and turned the music up. In Montrose, they parked the car outside a hair salon that had a tattoo parlor upstairs. They got out and Jane took a deep breath. This must be where Jane went to feel like Houston was her city, not just some place she accidentally wound up because her parents lived there. The sad part was Jane's pride in her insider knowledge, as if it were hard won. As if anyone couldn't walk into any city and find the artists and gays and addicts and tattoo parlors within half an hour by bumming a couple of cigarettes and picking up the free papers on the street corner. The salon was full of clients, but the woman behind the counter eyed Julie and said she could get her color started and then cut her next customer's hair while the dye was processing. Julie eased into the chair, felt the woman's fingers in her hair, and saw her look down critically. She said, "Short and red," fast, before the woman could comment on her roots. The woman met her eyes in the mirror and said,
"Okay, hon, let me get the book."
She left and came back with a floppy binder full of inch-long swatches like the silken manes of tiny horses, or trophies of all the girls she'd ever been. Julie pointed to one, and the woman nodded.
"Oh, sure, number 8, that'll look good on you."
And she disappeared into the back to mix the dye. Jane stood behind her, looking at her face in the mirror.
"Mom'll freak," she said. "But I think it's gonna look amazing."
"What do you want to do while I'm cooking?"
"Look at magazines, I guess."
Jane shrugged. Julie could see the realization dawning in Jane's eyes that there was nothing particularly special about this place. Anywhere must seem hip when you're getting your hair dyed to piss off your mom. That gave Julie an idea.
"You could go upstairs," she said. "Get a tattoo while you're waiting."
"Think I'm made of money?" "Don't you have a credit card?"
"Mom co-signed. It'll show up on her bill."
A wave of generosity, accompanied by the need to get Jane out of the room before it became obvious she had roots, made Julie point at her Anna-bought purse on the floor. "She gave me a couple $100. Why don't you pay for my hair with your card, and I'll give you the cash. You can spend it upstairs." Jane hesitated.
"Don't tell me you don't have your next one already picked out."
Julie predicted something small and discreet, but visible.
"I was thinking of a little outline of Texas on my left ring finger,"
Jane admitted.
"So go on!"
"Mom will see," Jane said. "I figured I'd wait."
"Until what? Until you're 30? Come on. Quit hiding who you really are."
She could tell Jane was eating this up.
"You'll be okay down here?"
she said, reaching for the purse.
"Yeah, I don't mind magazines."
It was true. She used to ogle them in their plastic folders at the library when Cal dropped her off to study for the GED. Once she'd even smuggled a Better Homes and Gardens into the restroom and ripped out a picture of a fluffy white cake surrounded by silver and gold Christmas ornaments. Not for the recipe, just the picture. Now the magazine cake was crumpled in a dumpster somewhere in Jersey Village, where the bus had dropped her off, along with her shoes, a cheap gold necklace with a dangling horse charm, and her backpack full of souvenirs. All her earthly possessions. Except... She lurched forward, but it was too late. Jane was already digging through the floppy bag. Before she could even form the words, "Give it to me, I'll find it," Jane had the wallet in her hand and was fanning the ATM fresh 20s out of its pocket.
Julie sat back quickly, willing Jane not to notice the IDs in the wallet, the phone in the inner pocket of the purse, or her own momentary panic. But Jane just beamed at the stack of bills.
"Thanks,"
she said, and headed for the stairs. Just in time. The hairstylist was back in a black apron, holding a bowl full of glowing red paste in one hand and a brush in the other.
"This is going to be gorgeous," she said. "Trust me."
And Julie did. She really did. She leaned back and felt the cold goop applied to her part.
"We're getting rid of those nasty roots first," the stylist said, and continued to chatter the way good hairdressers do when they can tell you don't want to say much.
At one point, she said,
"My sister and I are like y'all. We look so different, people never believe we're related."
She let the stylist tilt her chin down toward the floor and finally figured out something that had been bothering her since her arrival in Houston. It had been nagging at the corners of her vision everywhere she went, from Target to the therapist to Bobby's pool hall to the weathered brick coffee shop where Jane had insisted on stopping for pastries on the way to the hair place. Something not quite right, some quality that made the whole city feel like a stage set. Now, surrounded by other clients and with her head pointed floorward, looking under the table with its big mirror, she could see them propped up on footrests on the other side, all in a row. The shoes. They were pristine. The patent leather flats so shiny, the soles of the Reebok sneakers fluorescent yellow, the miraculously white leather sandals with gold lions on them, framing brightly polished toenails without a single chip. Staring at the floor, she cast her mind back through the past few weeks and saw a parade of flip-flops and leather boots looking as unscuffed as if they'd just come out of the box. She could see, framed by the black plastic smock, her own feet, perched on the silver bar in Jane's Converse, which had felt comfortably worn. Now she noticed that the tiny holes in the canvas, one near the right toe, another on the side, another near the heel, were too perfectly placed. She'd worn through shoes before. The canvas should have been frayed under the laces, the holes should have bloomed unattractively along the seam of the heel, not in neat little ovals in the middle of the fabric, and the rubber should have been thin enough under the soles for her to feel every pebble on the sidewalk. These weren't worn. They were distressed. She imagined a city divided between those like herself and the kid with the oversized pants, people whose shoes endured a constant pounding, scuffing, sweating, straining, and staining with grass and mud and soft oozing tar, and those who whooshed past them in SUVs, the ones who never walked more than 20 steps outside each day, much less to a bus stop or convenience store, and whose shoes, therefore, never wore out. She wished for a moment she could tell Cal. Not Jane, though. Jane had never walked anywhere. She would have found ways to rebel against Anna and Tom without ever having to rebel against that. The hairdresser tilted Julie's head back up, and she glanced at the ceiling, hoping, for Jane's sake, that the needle upstairs wasn't hurting her too much. 4. If Tom suspects the ovarian cyst is not an ovarian cyst, he doesn't say anything about it, and I, in return, say nothing about the gun that appeared in his hand last night. After we settled Julie on the sofa Monday morning with hot tea and the remote control, she turns on a cable movie that's already halfway over, one of those holiday-themed romantic comedies with 6 different plots, so isolated from one another that most of the stars probably never shared a soundstage. I notice a little princess, which I went back and got her that first week, still lying in its plastic wrapping on top of the Blu-ray player. I sit next to her with her feet in my lap under the afghan, rubbing them absently. She looks incredibly weary, and within 15 minutes she has fallen asleep, her night in pain having caught up with her. I move her bundled feet gently off my lap, slip the remote from under her arm, and mute the television just as some stockbroker in a natty suit looks up, realizes it's 5 minutes until midnight, and tears out of his office to propose to the actress on the other side of the movie. Tom is in the kitchen, putting the breakfast dishes away before he goes upstairs to work. The thought of Tom's presence in Julie's room is not the only reason I don't want to go back to bed. The tiredness nags at me, but something else does too.
I have to pick up some papers from my office, I say.
I hate to leave just now, but she'll sleep for a while. I glance at Julie,
and I need to get it over with so I can start working on grades.
Tom doesn't need to know that I've successfully lobbied the chair of my department to let me turn in final grades at the end of the summer. It's amazing how sensitive department heads are to my particular brand of family emergency, the kind that involves knives and young daughters and the national news. Tom looks at me mutely from the kitchen, and I admit to myself that I'd feel better if I knew how long I've been living in a house with a loaded gun.
Will you be around in case she wakes up? I ask instead.
Of course, he says.
Is she...
I told you she's fine, I snap, then soften.
I just don't want her to wake up all alone.
He nods. On the phone with Carol Morse in the car, I must sound a little off, although I feel my request to see her is perfectly reasonable. After all, she's invited me to make an appointment with her before. Do you want to come in with Julie this afternoon? She asks.
I know Julie won't be coming this afternoon. She'll be sleeping. But I can tell Carol about that when I see her.
No. I thought this time I would just... I want to see you by myself.
All right, she says, and then, I have a cancellation this morning at 11. Can you make that?
It's probably her lunch break. Maybe I sound worse than I think I do. I kill an hour at the paperback bookstore next to her office, thumbing through romances and mysteries. When I walk in, I'm somewhat surprised to find her younger than I remembered, no older than me, and wearing chino capris. For some reason, this bothers me.
Come in,
she says, and gestures me over to a sofa with a woven blanket draped over one arm. I notice a box of tissues sitting on the side table by a lamp with an artfully lumpy ceramic base, and I wonder if Julie ever cries here. Carol Morse closes the door and sits opposite me in a low-backed chair.
Thanks for fitting me in, I say, suddenly nervous. I hope this is... It's a little strange. It's about Julie.
How is Julie? She asks with an appropriate degree of concern.
Fine. Well, not fine, I say. She's sick today, so she won't be coming in.
Carol just looks at me, but for some reason I don't want to tell her about the hospital. Right now it's the only secret Julie and I share. Perhaps I'm afraid to find out Carol already knows. I continue, probing, to see whether she'll volunteer the information on her own.
I was sort of hoping you could help me out with Julie a little. I feel like she's keeping things from me. And I know you can't talk about what she says to you, but I have some things to tell you that might change your mind on that.
On patient confidentiality, that's impossible.
Even for a parent?
Especially for a parent. She looks at me levelly.
Anna, are you aware that your daughter hasn't come to her sessions for the past 2 weeks? After a stunned pause, I manage to say,
Carol, how could I be aware of that since nobody bothered to tell me?
She stays silent for long enough that I become uncomfortably conscious of my hostile tone.
I mean, no, I had no idea. She's been saying she's coming here. I just assumed... I mean, wouldn't you think we would want to know that?
Julie is an adult, the woman says coolly. Her appointments are completely confidential.
I have a sudden picture of Carol Morse at home with her husband, listening to Fleetwood Mac in the jacuzzi she surely has on the back deck of the house she purchased by taking strangers' money for reassurances that their lives are okay, that everything will work out. With difficulty, I control my urge to get up.
She was here for the first two sessions. I know she was, I say. Can you tell me anything about what she said? Can you tell me
anything at all?
I have to get something out of this woman.
Please.
She hasn't told us anything beyond what's in the police report, which
I can't bring myself to say that what she told the police isn't true. Not all of it, anyway. While I am searching for the words to tell her about the hospital and the ultrasound, Carol Morse says,
Have you asked Julie?
Have I asked Julie? Have I... Something shorts out in my brain. I want to stand and shriek. I want to knock over the artful ceramic lamp and fling the woven throw to the ground and stomp on it. Instead, I ask, "Do you have children?"
"No, I don't," she says evenly.
"I can tell," I say. I grab my purse, standing up.
"Mrs. Whittaker," she says.
"Doctor," I snap.
"Doctor?"
"Davalos."
"Dr. Davalos.
Oh, you can call me Anna."
"Anna,"
she says, refusing to take the bait. She's not even standing, and although I want to storm out, somehow the fact that she is still sitting in her low-backed chair keeps me from doing so for a moment longer.
"Anna."
Julie has had an incredibly difficult time, I can tell you that much. The trauma of what she's been through is not something most people can imagine. She wants to talk about trauma. "Many survivors of sexual abuse feel an overwhelming sense of shame," she says, "especially when the abuse is prolonged and combined with other trauma. She needs to feel that she's safe talking to you." "Of course she's safe," I say. Angry tears have started streaming down my face despite my efforts. She's not sure how to relate to her family anymore, or to anyone who hasn't been through what she has. She might protect you from the details because she doesn't want to make you sad or upset.
"Just tell me," I beg.
"Your job is to let her know you love her no matter what happened."
"Please."
"Anna, don't you want to come sit down? We have 30 more minutes in this appointment. I feel like it would be good for you to talk to someone as well. Don't you think that's true?" I get out of there and into my car so fast I'm almost halfway home before it occurs to me to swing by the university. Both to substantiate my lie, there might really be student papers after all, and to sit behind a closed door with a lock on it and think. I don't want to see or talk to anyone right now, not even Julie. When I get to my office, I notice a flashing red light on the phone indicating that I have messages. It takes me a second to figure out how to retrieve them. Hardly anybody calls office phones these days. The first three messages are from reporters, and I delete them without listening past the introduction. After the fourth beep,
"Dr. Davalos, this is Alex Mercado. I'm a private investigator. I know you aren't talking to the press right now, and I don't need to ask you any questions. Actually, I have some information to share with you. Some things I think you'll be interested in knowing. So, give me a call back."
He leaves a phone number.
"Again, it's Alex Mercado, and I'd like to meet somewhere and talk face to face, if that's okay."
"End of message," says the female voice recording. "To repeat this message, press..." I copy the number down on the second listening. Then I listen to the message two or three more times before deleting it, just to make sure I'm really hearing someone self-identify as a private investigator on my voicemail. I am. We never hired a PI to find Julie. We had so much faith in the police then, a thought that presses a burst of angry laughter out of me now. I suppose I thought of private eyes as a solution only for people in movies. But then I wasn't the one in charge of the solutions, or much of anything, for a while. The first thing I do now is turn on my desktop computer and Google Alex Mercado, private investigator. He comes up right away under a link for AMI Incorporated, which leads to a website so corny I think, there is no way this isn't fake. There's actually a fedora in the logo. What next, a magnifying glass? I open a new tab and start looking around for websites where PIs are registered, searching for credentials. Back when Julie disappeared, there were crackpots. We didn't want to change our number because we still believed she might try to contact us, and even though the police had a special tip line set aside for Julie, we still got the calls. "I have information you'll want to know," they always said. Or, "I saw her. I swear to God it was her. She's in Tucson." Or, "She's in Jacksonville." Or, "She's in Missouri City." One or two of them refused to be referred to the police. "It has to be you, and it has to be in person." Needless to say, the police were listening in on our line, which I assumed had as much to do with their suspicion of Tom and me as anything else. God, what a time. and the calls must have all been traced to lonely, middle-aged men living with their ailing mothers, or teenagers playing games of truth or dare, because none of them turned up any leads. At the time, I found it hard to believe that so many people would want to be a part of such a horrible circumstance. But in the years since, the years of forgotten nightmares and long commutes past her hundreds of imaginary graves, I have almost felt I understood them. It's so easy to forget how terrible the world is. Tragedy reminds us. It is purifying in that way. But when it starts to fade, you have to return to the source over and over. When I find a reliable-looking registration site searchable by zip code, I am surprised to find that Alex Mercado Investigations is the second name to come up. On the AMI website, I click the About Us link and am treated to Alex Mercado's credentials. Almost 3 years as a police detective in the Special Victims Unit of the Houston Police Department. 6 years as a private detective. A few links to news stories about crimes that the agency claims to have helped solve. One of the links mentions his name. I pick up the phone and dial. A male voice answers after the second ring. Alex Mercado Investigations. Is this Anna Davalos? Yes, I say, a bit startled, although of course he would have caller ID. You left a message earlier. Thanks for getting back to me, he says. Look, I realize this is a little odd, but I would really like to meet you and talk about some things. About Julie? Of course. I don't feel comfortable saying more on the phone. Would you be able to meet me somewhere? Yes, but it has to be today. It has to be now. It's remarkable how easy it is to finish this conversation. I suggest a diner, not the cutesy retro kind you find around my neighborhood, but a Waffle House near the freeway. I feel my pulse racing, but my voice stays absolutely cool and untroubled as I say, I'll meet you there in half an hour. It's like I set up things like this every day. Just before I'm about to hang up, he asks one last question as if he can't resist. Have you ever heard of Gretchen Farber? No, I say. Who's that? Don't worry about it, he says. I'll see you in half an hour. Gretchen made one mistake, and the mistake's name was Cal. He was supposed to be another rung on the ladder out of the dark hole she had come from. It was her fault he'd become more. At the time, she'd been planning her next move for so long it felt inevitable. As soon as the set was over, she smiled, murmured thank you into the mic, and slipped off stage fast. She headed toward the ladies' room but swerved past it fluidly at the last second, slipping out the back door instead, and then pounding through the alleyway and around to the front entrance. Then she waited. 1 minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, heart throbbing painfully from the sprint and her skin prickling in the chill. Coatless, her black Salvation Army trench still slouched up alibi style next to her purse backstage. At least it wasn't raining, for once, aside from a little halo of mist around the neon club sign. And then he was there, pulling his collar up as he emerged onto the sidewalk, the neon light shining pink on his shaved head. She steeled herself to make his dreams come true, trying to look as if she'd been waiting for someone else when he happened to step into her path. Hey, do you have a cigarette? I'm dying. He just looked at her, blinked for a moment, then broke into a helpless smile.
I don't smoke, he said. I'm sorry.
Don't be. It's a nasty habit. I'm not supposed to be doing it. If my band sees me, they'll kill me. She gestured toward her throat, opened her mouth, pointing into it as if he could see the damage that cigarettes had already done to her vocal cords. Then she remembered Will's hands at her neck, how she'd worn a turtleneck but couldn't sing for 2 days afterward. Will had told Dave and Len she had laryngitis.
Are you okay?
He asked suddenly, his smile going out. She had only 30 more seconds to get this settled, so she let herself come a little unsewn, just enough to throw a natural wobble into her voice. Rough night, she admitted. Honestly, I kind of need a break from those guys. Where are you headed?
Nowhere, he said. Home? Do you need a ride?
Yeah, she said. If you're okay swinging by a drugstore or something for smokes, she laughed. I'm sorry, I feel like a complete weirdo.
No, it's okay, he said,
and she knew it was far more than that. She was still watching the door just behind him out of the corner of her eye. Plenty of people were smoking under the sign, but there was no one out here she didn't want to see, yet. The door flapped open.